the campus of Henry Ford College, you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this February 28th edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw with you. We've got a special treat for you in our first segment today. It is an airing from an event that took place this week earlier here on the campus of HFC. It is titled the Black History and Culture Student Showcase. So in honor of Black History Month, we will turn things over to student activities in just a few seconds with an airing of a recording from their Black History and Culture Student Showcase. And then in our second segment, we will hear a public radio exchange presentation that was just added to their portal earlier this month. It's called Aaron Robertson, The Black Utopians. Hear about his fascinating book, The Black Utopians, Searching for Paradise and the Promised Land in America. There are some Detroit references as well, so I think you'll find that fascinating. As we wrap up Black History Month right here on WHFR Radio and the WHFR Journal. Stay tuned. I'm Susan McGraw, and enjoy the show.
My name is Kayla Collins. I am the Student Activities Associate here at Henry Ford College. And Director Cassandra Fluker, the Director of Student Activities, and myself make up the Office of Student Activities. So we are here today because we believe that cultural activities are essential to the development of students. Today we are excited to welcome you to the Student Showcase, Black History and Culture. And so before getting started, I want to emphasize that the teaching and celebration of Black history is essential. We do so each year to honor and recognize the achievements, contributions, and rich heritage of African Americans. It's a time to reflect and appreciate those who came before us. And for those of us who are not of that same heritage, it's an opportunity to celebrate the beauty of diversity and learn. Listen to others' voices and foster a deeper understanding of the African American experience, because truly Black history is American history. Even when February is over, I hope that we can continue to highlight the importance of celebrating and learning about Black history, along with the various other cultures that are represented in our beautifully diverse community at Henry Ford College. So, our event today will feature student performances of various types. The goal is to allow students to express themselves and highlight forms of Black culture that are particularly meaningful to them. This is a celebration of culture, community, and creativity. And it intends to show that Black culture pushes beyond the boundaries of what we may traditionally consider to be normal for Black art. Art is essential to the human experience, and so naturally, Black art is as varied as the artists themselves. It is personal, but also tied to one's larger context, culture, history, and society. It has the power to speak in ways that words may fail, and it holds the power to teach, bring about change, and move you in ways that you may not expect. And so I am so excited to have our wonderful guests here today to show off their passions and focus on just one of the many fundamental aspects of Black history, that being cultural arts and creative performance. So to start off, we are going to be welcoming Mary Hawthorne. Mary has been a member of the HFC community for many years, and has contributed to various choral groups like the HFC Chorus, Blue Fusion, and the Dearborn Community Chorus. With her wonderful voice and passion for performing, Mary is a renowned singer at HFC and beyond. Her interests include shopping, listening to music, cooking, and of course singing. She has been recognized as the Henry Ford College Zudik Chorister of the Year, and she's also a Mumford High School Honor Roll student. We are so excited to welcome Mary to the stage, and she will be singing What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. Let's welcome Mary.
Mother, 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 there's far too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah, picket lines and picket signs. Don't you punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, oh, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, 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 yeah. Mother, mother, everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us simply 'cause our hair is long? Oh, you know we got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't you punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me so you can see. What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much, Mary. All right, next we are excited to welcome Cameron Freeman for an art showcase. Cameron D. Freeman is a student in the graphic design program here at HFC. He currently works at the school newspaper, The Mirror News, as a graphic design co-op designing illustrations. In his free time, he enjoys comics and video games. Today, Cameron will be showcasing one of his visual art pieces. So let's welcome him to the stage.
I hope everyone's having a good day today. I would like to give a round of applause to the performance that we just had. It was really great. And to be completely honest, there's probably no way I'm going to be able to top that today. But today I want to talk about the piece that I made. It is, take this one second. So today last night, I drew a picture of Black Panther. Now, obviously, just looking at it, you're like, oh, it's a comic book character. No one's thinking too much about it. But the creation of Black Panther was in 1966, when a lot of black issues were going on, black power movement, stuff like that. And the creator, Jim Kirby, a Jewish white man, noticed that there wasn't many black characters within Marvel Comics. A lot of them were white faces within his comic strips, and there wasn't much color being shown. So he decided to take matters into his own hands and create the character Black Panther, a character that not only went against the stereotypes of that time, but also introduced people to the continent of Africa, and showing that it's much more than just poverty, destruction, and obviously negative connotations. But that's what I drew. I drew Black Panther. He's probably one of the most influential black characters to this day, and probably the reason for why we have more black comic characters being shown. That's pretty much it, though. Thank you for letting me speak about my piece. And you guys have a wonderful day.
What a beautiful art piece. Thank you, Cameron. I'm sharing some history as well. I can't believe he just did that all in a night. It's beautiful. Thank you. All right. Next up, we're going to be welcoming Mita Martin. As an alumna of the former Specs Howard School of Media Arts and a graduate of the Henry Ford College's Culinary Arts Program, Ms. Mita Jewel Martin is a returning student to HFC to continue her education in media communication arts. Ms. Mita, as she is affectionately known, is an advocate of higher learning and a student for life. She uses her love of learning, her knowledge, her love of God, and her passion for community to uplift and encourage others. The only girl in a family of four older brothers, Miss Mita stood out at an early age as a born storyteller. Throughout her teen years, she was found to be a gifted writer of poetry, short stories, and songs, and performed within her local church community. Miss Mita grew up as an old soul, relishing wisdom from her elders, and has a strong passion for learning, history, truth, and sharing what she calls life lessons. Her creative soul and passion for educating is what makes her a great storyteller. Being a strong communicator, Miss Mita also worked at the Henry Ford in Greenfield Village as a professional storyteller for 10 years, in the position of a historical presenter, which is a narrator, public speaker, and historical reenactor. Before introducing Mita to read her original poem, we will have her talk a little bit about a song that she would like to play first. So let's welcome Mita.
Hello, everyone. We're celebrating Black History Month. This is very, very important, as everybody, Almighty God, affirms the value of everybody, man or woman. And today, this presentation is going to be about the contribution, the celebration, the resilience, the power, the beauty, the stamina, the strength of the Black woman, for whom none of us would be without. We need each and every race, every culture, everybody is important, and this is the celebration and strength and picture of the Black woman. This is from the movie 6888, if you haven't seen it. It is very, very important. It is historical because it talks about the Black woman's contribution in a very racist society and a very white military. And here they came and they achieved, they dominated, and only now, after most all of them in the platoon, 800 something women are all gone, now America is saying, we recognize, we see, they came, they did, they conquered, they achieved. And so today, I am representing the Black woman. 6888 is about the only Black woman platoon that was in the military many decades ago. They called for them to do something that the white officers would not do, that no one could do, and that was to get millions of pieces of mail through to the soldiers whose stamina, whose courage, their faith was failing. And the government had to figure out how to process this mail to keep these men going. And so no one would go, no one would do it. They thought it was beneath them. And this Black woman platoon of 850 soldiers captained by a Black woman, she said, we'll do it. They said, well, we'll give you 9 months. She said, we'll do it in six. Hallelujah. And they got it done, and they changed the face of this country. They changed the face of America. The white men saluted them from the highest all the way down because they did something that everybody said they couldn't do. Why? Because they were brown-skinned. The idea that humans are created in God's image means that humans have inherent worth and dignity. It also means that humans should respect and honor all people, regardless of differences. Some ways that humans reflect God's image include the ability to create, the ability to reason, the ability to think rationally, the ability to experience emotions in the way humans relate to God and others. A virtuous woman who can find. Virtuous woman means force and strength. A woman of influence and strength. Spirituality, strong mentality, morally and physically. The Almighty designed the woman for the purpose of first following Him, glorifying Him, submitting to His leadership, loving Him, and keeping Him for right. Maya Angelou, one of the first, she was the first black woman movie director, television director ever in Hollywood. She wrote numerous books. She was a professor for 32 years. Dr. Maya Angelou wrote the musical score for Georgia, Georgia. She went on to write many, many acclaimed and award-winning songs, television series. She received a Golden Eagle Award for PBS for writing the documentary on Afro-Americans in the arts. And one of her most famous, some of you may remember, that she wrote the poem, the inauguration poem for Barack Obama. That had never been done by a black woman ever in history. And in this poem, this most famous poem, not that one, but this one, Phenomenal Woman, the last stanza reads, "Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need for my care, cause I'm a phenomenally, I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman, that's me." I want to encourage the women as we play the montage. We're going to show some pictures of women, black women in history for their contributions. Believe it or not, it started with even the laundry wringer on the washer. A black woman put it there. The torpedo discharger that the United States military uses to this day as a standard for the discharger that they use on their own dischargers. And she never went to school, this black woman. As this montage goes, I'm going to read, "Brown-skinned woman. I am more than just a body, smooth brown skin, permanent beyond a tan, voluptuous breasts, pear-shaped hips. I offer more than stereotypical fantasy sex. I am a brown-skinned woman. Rich in culture, proud of my heritage, I embrace our traditions. I can and have endured many things. I have an amazing, blessed strength. I boggle the world's mind. I knock the barriers down time after time. I can't be enslaved. I can't be broken and torn down too long. My soul is gonna find a way free and live on somehow, some way. I am a brown-skinned woman. Mother of beautiful brown-skinned children, teaching them how to succeed and to survive, loving them with great passion, but taming them when they are wild, raising our children, most of us doing the very best that we can, working, keeping the house, and taking care of business with and without a man. I am a brown-skinned woman. Strong, intelligent, independent, beautiful, exotic, regal, vibrant, funny, complex, lovable, sincere, and unforgettable. I am a formidable being to be reckoned with. I am a brown-skinned woman. My style, the way I wear my hair, my form of expression, the way I move, dance, walk, the way I pray, sing, and talk. I cook a great meal. I'm ingenious, totally creative. My inventions improve and change the way the world operates. First woman millionaire created beautiful products with which you comb your hair. On your washer, I put the laundry wringer there. I created the torpedo discharger on your submarine. I ran the Underground Railroad that helped relocate our enslaved brothers and sisters. And I found my way led by the stars in the sky. I am a brown-skinned woman. I sang songs of cold just to be able to pray, encourage and bond with my people in the days of old. I am a magnificent creation. I am a brown-skinned woman. Thank you. And I want to, this is for all women. In celebration of the brown or the black woman, it's also a celebration of all women as we stand on black women's shoulders, as we stand on each other's shoulders. It doesn't matter what generation, what age, where you come from. It doesn't matter. It matters who you are and that you were purposed. Stand up, women. Stand up, women. Know who you are. Know that you were born for such a time as this. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter your mother, that your mother, your sister, your niece, your, it doesn't matter if you think you can or you think you can't. It doesn't matter the quantity of people in your corner. It matters the quality of people in your corner. But first be in your own corner. Stand up, women, be counted. Laughing out loud, why can't we in some cultures? Are our captors afraid that our laughter of joy will somehow bring down the walls of their abusive terror, causing them to crumble like the trumpets that broke down the walls of Jericho? Yes, it is possible. Stand up, women, be counted. Beautifying ourselves, putting on makeup or dressing up to make ourselves feel good intimidates them. Why? Are they afraid we will be empowered by discovering our own beauty and thus using it as a strength to motivate ourselves to move from their abusive hands with self-love? Yes, it is possible. Stand up, women. Be counted. What? We cannot go to school? No matter our age or our financial situation or our culture or what neighborhood we come from, what? We cannot go to school? Who are they to dictate that to us? We cannot educate ourselves, furthering our dreams and goals and becoming better persons? Why? Are they afraid that we will outrank them? We will outsurpass them? Yes, it is possible. Stand up, women. Be counted. They beat us and use us as sex slaves in this sex trafficking. Being raped can scar a body and a mind, yet this is being done to us. Why? Are they afraid that we may not fear them, leaving them feeling underpowered and emasculated? So yes, it is possible. Stand up, women. Be counted. Those that are doing these things to us, they are weak-minded individuals. Women, we are also empowered by the love, grace, and mercy of Almighty God. We are not meant to be abused, mutilated, controlled, or shrunk down by anyone, not even by each other. Stand up, women, and be counted. We must do this, women. If not for ourselves, we must think about the legacy we are leaving behind for the little girls that are yet to come, and boys and young men who are watching us, who care very little, who do not understand. We have the strength, women, by Almighty God, who purposed us just as he purposed men. We have the strength. Stand up, women. Stand up and be counted.
Next, we're going to hear from the HFC Chorus. HFC Chorus is the home of multicultural, multiracial, multigender, and multigenerational vocal musicians from all across the Henry Ford College community. The chorus performs a variety of music from around the world, including classical, musical theater, pop, and jazz. The chorus has toured as far as Grand Rapids, Chicago, Kalamazoo, Stratford, and Toronto, and has also performed for HFC commencement ceremonies, civic functions, and community organizations. The chorus will be singing at the Collage Concert at the Dearborn Performing Arts Center on March 5th, and right here on campus in Adray Auditorium on April 24th. Let's give it up for the amazing Henry Ford College Chorus, led by director Amy Sari.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having us once again at our second annual appearance at the Black History Month Student Showcase. a brief introduction on the piece we're about to sing. It is called Bon Seaba, and it is a Zambian folk song that is intended for welcome. And you may think, why a welcome song for a finale piece of this program? Well, the intention is to welcome all of you into a world where Black History Month is not just a month. Not just a month, but Black history is ongoing. Ongoing all year round, and something that all of us can embrace. So please enjoy this welcome song, Bon Seaba.
Bon Seaba, Lubokele, La Bale, Bele, Maka, Akuba, Bana.
Bon Seaba, Lubokele, La Bale, Bele, Maka, Akuba, Bana.
Bon Seaba, Lubokele, La Bale, Bele, Maka, Akuba, Bana.
Akuba, Bana.
Akuba, Bana.
Absolutely beautiful as always. Thank you so much. Okay, last but certainly not least, we are going to welcome Professor Paul Rogers. Professor Paul Rogers has been an educator for almost 30 years. He's been at Henry Ford College for over 20 years. As a lover of the arts, Professor Rogers sings and performs in the metropolitan Detroit area with a local band. He also has two publications, a biocritical essay on the late writer Melvin Dixon and the Encyclopedia of African American Literature, Facts on File, 2007, and a poem in the anthology Black Gay Genius, Answering Joseph Beam's Call, Vintage Entity Press, 2014. Professor Rogers is currently editing and revising his novel, Lovin' on Next to Nothin', for publication. He's also working on a book of poetry. Let's welcome Professor Rogers.
So we're going through so much in the world right now, and I've been feeling this this need for a universal love. I think that love is the cure to most things that ail us. And so this particular poem is called Universal Love, This Is My Prayer. Many late nights thinking of those I loved, those who loved me, dreaming to the moons and stars, the heavens and beyond, still working, learning what I need to know, living my life with luxuries at hand, yet my heart desires universal love. A love that cannot fail, but will heal the healing of something you cannot get on Amazon. Oh, not just people, the sky, the oceans, the birds and the trees, life in the ocean. This is universal love. Without boundaries of class, race, gender, gender identities, sexual orientation, or religious affiliation, a universal love that celebrates all. This is my prayer.
What a wonderful way to close us out. Thank you. I hope that we move forward into this month and to all months with love, a greater appreciation of other cultures, and celebration of culture and what makes us humans, which is creating art and growing. So thank you so much for coming. So happy to have you, and be sure to check out the rest of the programs going on this month. And if you have ideas for other programs you'd like to see, please let us know.
What the example of the Black Utopians can teach us.
What we want to attain in the world is going to happen easily. It's never been true, and right now that is especially the case. But I think if you go into these next few years knowing that and understanding that, it may allow us all to adjust and try to go forward in some way.
That's Aaron Robertson. We talk with him about his fascinating book, The Black Utopians, Searching for Paradise and the Promised Land in America. It's about the hidden legacies of Black Utopian experiments and what they teach us about the power of community today. Then, Trump is taking a wrecking ball to every form of consumer protection we have, but the rot started long before him.
So much of the last, 40 years is the story of an economy that is increasingly overtaken by fraud that we just call business.
That's Cory Doctorow. We talk with him about his new crime thriller, the latest installment in the Martin Hench series, Picks and Shovels. It tells the origin story of forensic accountant Martin Hench and the most powerful tool for crime ever invented, the personal computer. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Donald Trump is trying to erase Black History Month, but that won't fly on Writer's Voice. Every week this month, we'll be featuring books about key times in America's Black history, a history that enriches and enlightens us all. That includes Aaron Shetterly talking about his book Morningside, the 1979 Greensboro Massacre. Victoria Christopher Murray tells us about her novel of the Harlem Renaissance, Harlem Rhapsody. And Bernadette Atuahene talks about the history of how racist policies undermine Black home ownership in America. Today, we're joined by Aaron Robertson, author of The Black Utopians. His book covers the rich yet often overlooked history of Black utopian communities in America, places born from struggle, but driven by hope, self-determination, and perseverance. From the historic town of Promised Land, Tennessee, to the radical vision of Black Christian nationalism in Detroit, Robertson takes us on a journey through forgotten movements that sought to build a better world right here in America. Aaron Robertson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Your book, The Black Utopians, moves between personal history and the history of Black utopian experiments in the 20th century, although you do go back to one that began in the 19th century. I'm not sure you include it as precisely a utopian experiment, but I think that it really does fit the bill. Your grandparents had a farm in Promised Land, Tennessee. Tell us about that historic Black town and your family's association with it.
I definitely do count Promised Land as one of the many utopian communities that I write about in the book. So Promised Land was an all-Black town that was founded west of Nashville in 1870. So, you know, just 5 years after the Civil War ended. And this was a place that existed for about 100 years or so. And my grandfather grew up there. Like, he was born there in the 1940s. And although the population declined in the mid-20th century, this was always a kind of a space for familial gatherings. And I grew up going there as a kid. And I didn't really have an appreciation at the time for the historical significance of a place like Promised Land. It was one of hundreds of these all-Black settlements that existed across the United States. Not all Black families came from a place like Promised Land, which I would realize, like as I got older, it represented for me the kind of historical starting point of communities that African Americans created in order to kind of escape, so much of the sort of social and economic and political restrictions that had historically been imposed on them. I wanted to start from both a personal and historical place in order to tell a much broader story about similar kinds of communities.
There have been many utopian experiments in American history, but what makes these different is how they emerged out of such a history of terrible persecution and persecution that continues through today. It's not as if that's just in the past. And in fact, you spoke with people, well, your book does center on those experiments that began in the interwar period, and then, a lot of the book focuses on those that were in the 1960s, when there was, the counterculture movement that emerged a lot out of privilege, not so much for those experiments that were in the Black community. So I wonder if you could address this. It's like a paradise built in hell, to use the words of Rebecca Solnit. Talk about this tension between how these communities emerged out of such terrible oppression, how was their vision different? Just to frame the larger environment of these.
I think that within American history, when people talk about American utopias, we tend to focus on two general time periods. One of those is the sort of early 19th century, like where you had predominantly, if not exclusively, white utopian socialist communities. So places like New Harmony and, Indiana. We had also the kind of establishment of the Shakers, and that's one story. But then there's this sort of tumultuous period in the 1960s and 70s when you're seeing the explosion of all kinds of countercultural movements. A lot of us may think of the hippies and kind of the back to the land, communes that were spreading in the 1970s. I had always been really interested in the history of American countercultures, but so much of the conversation about American utopianism seemed to leave out the experiences of Black Americans. I think that, groups like the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam tended to be the ones that got most of the attention during that period. But there were so many other groups and so many other initiatives throughout the 20th century that I think embodied this sort of anti-authority, anti-capitalist approach to life that I wanted to explore. And so the main group that I write about in the book began in a Black nationalist church in Detroit called the Shrine of the Black Madonna. And this was a church, founded by a revolutionary Black nationalist pastor named Albert Clegg Jr. And he began this sort of social and political movement that he called Black Christian nationalism. And it was so fascinating to learn about because here was a church that began in Detroit that would then go on to establish these Black communes, not only in Detroit, but also in places like Atlanta and Houston. This was a kind of quintessential American utopian community. But these narratives were not well known at all, and I wanted to explore like why that might have been.
Well, I mean, aside from the obvious ways in which I think American society doesn't elevate the voices of Black people in this country unless forced to. What are some of the reasons that you think these are lesser known?
Yeah, well, you know, in part, I think there's a broader answer, which is the way that people have been taught to think about utopia, right, as the kind of achievement of, if not, you know, a perfect state of living, one that is predominantly defined by a sense of optimism, by a sense of hope, right? Like that has usually been seen as contradicting the nature of Black American history, you know, writ large, right? We tend to focus, I think, on histories of, if not oppression, of, you know, great political struggle and social struggle. And all of that is there. But I think the attempt to, you know, create a better life, to create a better world, is also rooted in creativity and joy. But it takes a while for that narrative, I think, to take root. But in the case of the Black Christian nationalists, the period of American utopianism was also the period where new groups like this would often be monitored by government agencies, right? This was still a Black liberation movement. So they faced the same kinds of pressures that so many other Black nationalist groups faced from the FBI, from local police, etc. But there was always a kind of discomfort around groups that in some ways attempted to set themselves apart from the rest of American society, especially when those groups were religious in nature. So the Black Christian nationalists were sometimes, you know, misunderstood and mislabeled by the press as a kind of cultish community. That was not actually true. But I think, like Jim Jones' church, the People's Temple, that became kind of the face of American utopian experiments gone wrong, right? And I think that there was a tendency to conflate separatist communal groups with a kind of extremism that tended to push these groups to the margins. And that's what happened with the Black Christian nationalists too.
So talk about this term Black Christian nationalism, because of course we live in a time of resurgence of white Christian nationalism. So it would be easy, I think, for people to try to conflate the two. And I think what you're just talking about is how that might have even happened in the past, but they're quite different and came out of different traditions. So talk about those differences.
Yeah, very much so. It's funny because I started to write the book and to think of it in 2020. So this was, of course, before the insurrection happens in 2021 and before the term white Christian nationalism really takes hold. And as you said, they do come out of, you know, very different historical traditions. I would say that Black Christian nationalism, as Reverend Clay conceived of it, was intended to restore a sense of not only dignity among Black people, but also to encourage economic, political, and social self-determination. The mantra of movement was that nothing is more sacred than the liberation of Black people. And what that meant was not that other groups of people were somehow lesser, right, or not on the same plane. But in fact, it was attempting to, you know, to show African Americans that everything that they had been told about themselves was not true and could be resisted in really creative ways. Whereas white Christian nationalism is rooted in a long tradition of exclusion, of domination, right? If you're identity does not align, like, very cleanly with white Christian cis identity, right, you pose a threat to the ideology of white Christian nationalism. And so it's very important to establish these distinctions between these two very different movements. And in a way, I think that Black Christian nationalism is the sort of antithesis of the very kinds of really dangerous ideology that white Christian nationalism represents.
Now, another difference, Aaron Robertson, that you point out in this book, The Black Utopians, is that Black Christian nationalism emerged out of Christian socialism, Christian liberation theology to some degree. So tell us about that.
So, you know, Reverend Clegg is often considered one of the great practitioners of what some people call, you know, Black liberation theology or Black theology, which at its foundation, there's this belief that God is a God of the oppressed, and faith and religious traditions, in this case, the Christian faith, is really one that is aimed towards improving the lives of those who have been dispossessed and disinherited. In many ways, it is a kind of radical imagination of what Christianity could have meant in the lives of so many people. It was an attempt to root Christian principles in the everyday lives of Black Americans. And that is also at the root of what I mean when I write about Black utopianism. It's not a belief in a kind of hereafter, like that is really abstract and hard to get a grasp of. It's about what are the sort of moral and spiritual ideals that can then guide pragmatic action. It sort of is a wedding of idealism and pragmatism. That is what this specific group, the Black Christian Nationalists, stood for. But that was also the kind of relationship, I think, between thought and action that I wanted to explore among various groups in the book.
Say more about that. What were the ideals of this movement?
Well, one, the Black Christian Nationalists were interested in establishing sort of independent Black-led institutions in all areas of life. So one of the issues that really motivated Reverend Clegg in starting in the 1950s on was improving the education of Black children, the educational conditions in which Black children grew up. Because, you know, in Detroit at the time, so many African-American children were going to schools that were underfunded, you know, where classrooms were often crowded and there was, you know, poor lighting. And this was a really unsustainable way, you know, for kids to grow up in. And so Clegg was always looking for models to adapt. He was looking to the example of freedom schools in the 1960s, but he was also, you know, looking abroad for examples that the Black Christian Nationalists could adapt. There were Cuban liberation schools and sort of Soviet Union, you know, kindergartens, even that Clegg and his people studied.
And the kibbutzim.
Yes, right, exactly. Most notably, the shrine looked to the example of the kibbutzim in Israel. And the point of that was to encourage a real sense that children could create their own sort of destiny, like in their own communities, if they live together. And so this was like one example of many of how the Black Christian Nationalists looked not only within the U.S. to kind of explore different communal arrangements, but they also looked abroad, because so often it was hard, I think, for a group like this to feel that American values aligned with the kind of world they wanted to see. And when I say that, I mean this sort of emphasis on individualism and kind of capitalist accumulation, right? And even the, you know, nuclear family, right? All of these were things that Clegg to a degree, took issue with.
You write that Albert Clegg didn't like the word utopian. In fact, he called it realism. He also promoted what he called a strategy of chaos. So I wonder if you could just explain those two ideas, that this is not utopianism, it's realism, and to accomplish it, they needed a strategy of chaos.
Exactly. Clegg famously disliked the word utopian because he identified as a part of this American pragmatist tradition. And what that meant is simply that there was no one way to kind of achieve the goals that he wanted for his people. And so instead of thinking, for example, that Christianity was the sort of height of, you know, moral ideals, and that those were the only precepts one could follow to structure their life, Clegg said, well, no, as a movement, we need to be open to all kinds of ideas and all kinds of movements in order to sort of shape the world we want. And so Clegg was inspired by the Nation of Islam, for example, because they provided, in his eyes, a very concrete example of a sort of durable, self-determining, like Black nationalist movement. It didn't matter so much that this was a group that actually took a lot of issue with the Christian church, like with the very Christian church that Clegg grew out of. What mattered was the steps they took to attain material power and to build community wealth. And so like that is what Clegg meant by that. And he also was inspired by writers and thinkers like Frantz Fanon, who inspired this notion that Clegg had of chaos, right? Like there needs to be a strategy of chaos in order to make the world you want to see. And what it means is you have to be open to improvisation, right? Like you can strategize and you can try to build, to establish certain programs to guide your movement and your own actions. But the world does not work so cleanly, like, and it doesn't always align with the programs you lay out. And so there needs to be a certain amount of flexibility to the way you think. I think that Clegg was very skeptical of kind of sticking to one ideology, because that is so often the death of utopian movements. Like when you cling so strongly to one way of life or to one way of being, but the times around you are changing and you are needing to respond to the world as it is, if you hold on too strong, then your movement will probably fade away. And that was a challenge that the church itself faced at the beginning of the 21st century. You know, Clegg died in the year 2000. And once he passed away, there was a real rift within the Black Christian nationalist movement. You had some people who still held on, you know, very strongly to a lot of the values that had been espoused during the era of Black power. They still wanted this institution to be, in a sense, a Black nationalist church. But you had other people who said, well, the world has changed now, and it's harder to create communes. This is a more globalized world, and our kids were not raised in the same way of thinking that we were, right? Our kids want to actually explore the wider world. And so there was a tension between those who wanted to hold on to the Black power like way of thinking and those who were attempting to explore something beyond that.
So this is where I was really reading your book, Aaron Robertson. I was reading The Black Utopians. I couldn't help but read it from the point of view of a more general set of lessons that we can draw in this time, very much because this movement did emerge out of, you know, it was almost as if suffering was the wellspring of hope and reimagination. And I think that for many of us in this society, far beyond the Black community, although it's going to be pretty intense for the Black community as well, we're entering into a time where we have to find a way through suffering to reimagine things. You know, many people said people who voted for Trump wanted to burn everything down. And that's a terrifying thought, but reading your book, I thought to myself, well, if you do burn everything down, then that does, in fact, give some room for alternatives. So what are some of the lessons that you draw from your own book as we move into this period?
Yeah, like what I've learned in researching and writing about these kinds of movements, you know, and speaking to some of the people who lived through tumultuous social and political periods, like in the 1960s, is that at these moments of disaster or these real sort of turning points, as frightening as they can be, they also tend to be the same moments when these kind of utopian experiments really flourish, because there is a sense that maybe government or this kind of federal government or the way the world is trending right now that may not be able to provide always for your own family or your neighborhood or your city. There tends to be a real kind of turn to the local. And on the one hand, you know, it's sad and frustrating that we feel very atomized, like right now in this country. There is no real sense of unity, which is frightening. But also, I guess I personally feel really encouraged by the ways that like smaller scale communities are really embracing like mutual aid, are trying to provide for one another in very specific and tangible ways. It is hard to speak in terms of like lofty ideals for the future of our country right now. But I think that going forward, it's really kind of about attending to our neighbors. And that's the thing that's going to get us through what will be a very scary and harmful period in our country.
And Albert Clegg talked about acceptance of reality and preparation. And I agree. I think it's taking care of our neighbors that is really key. But what else might he tell us at this time for how we must prepare?
Clegg would say that the struggle is not going to end. And in fact, you know, like if there is one lesson about utopian ideals or even sort of orienting yourself towards the future, is that your work is not going to sort of end in one kind of glorious moment, right? Or like a glorious age of prosperity. But really, it is about finding the concerns in the world like that you have, that you can imagine yourself like constantly struggling for and constantly fighting for. I think we are so liable to be disappointed, you know, if we think that what we want to attain in the world is going to happen easily. It's never been true. And right now, that is especially the case. But I think if you go into these next few years knowing that and understanding that, it may allow us all to adjust and try to go forward in some way.
And we can really find so many inspiring examples in your wonderful book, beautifully written. I mean, we didn't even talk about the letters from your father. I want to just say to our listeners that is a beautiful part of this book as well. So many wonderful lessons and lessons of the heart, the Black Utopians. Thank you so much, Aaron Robertson, for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Light from the Underground is a radio show filled with musical surprises. You'll get a chance to hear new music, often artists you aren't familiar with, and we might even mix in some classics that you haven't thought of in years. I'm Bill Keith, and I enjoy digging through all the music we've received to spotlight the best music I can find. I focus on singer-songwriters across a wide variety of genres. Add in some blues or Americana, maybe a bit of gospel music, and some indie rock to mix things up, and you have Light from the Underground. Thanks to Henry Ford College for making WUHFR possible. Their investment allows us to create radio that's focused on Dearborn and the greater Detroit area. And thank you for being a loyal listener. Check out Light from the Underground Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on 89.3 WUHFR.FM. We're making waves.
There's a spring.
Mountain Stage returns to its previous time slot Saturday at 3 o'clock, right after Culture Collection, starting March 1st. And if you enjoyed hearing it on Mondays, it'll still be there at 12 noon here on 89.3 WHFR, the station that makes waves.
Listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Mexico.